That's what happens when you get to be an old man.
Jake Lupo, you're here for both, so you get two dots. All right, not too bad, not too bad. All right, these are for the people who are not here. P-R-O-F, prof. Write that down somewhere. P-R-O-F. L-I-M. A-N-E-K. ProfLemanic.com. That is my website. That is my own personal website. That's where you'll get the ability to get the information that you missed, because I record all my classes. So you have no excuse for not knowing what I talked about on Thursday, even though you were not here. Everybody else, you know what we're doing. Oh, I know. I'll dig it out. Get the introduction. Oh, God, we're talking about the Crusades. Epic. Epic, 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 epic. All right, so before I get this working properly, does anyone have any questions? Those of you who are here on Thursday, about anything that I touched upon. All right, for those of you who were not here, that today is your first day, listen to the recording, go over the website kind of as I talk about it, so that way you can understand what we're going to be doing in this class, so that way you can be on top of things, so that way you will not be falling behind, because we don't want to have you starting off out in last place. Hi. How are you? Who are you?
Rick Tree.
Who?
Rick Tree.
Oh, you sent me the email.
Yeah.
Welcome to campus.
Thank you.
I don't remember your last name.
Samson.
Poison. All right. There we go. Now the computer's working. So, anyways, as I was saying, those of you who today's day one, go on my website, listen to the lecture, and questions. Any questions that you have, please, 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 please ask. Because it's my expectation now of this point that you are completely or will be up to speed by the next time I see you again, which essentially means you'll be ready to go with what we got coming up. And of course, what is the first thing that's due? Oh, essay topic. Yeah, essay topic. Excellent. So make sure you're trying to figure that out as well. And I already have, I think, one person approved in here, which is so exciting. No, we don't want to go there. Why is this not working? Could be my hands are not. You know what happened to me at 4 o'clock in the morning? I got woken up when my house alarm started saying, power has been lost. So I get to start the day by firing up the generator and starting the day off cold. All right, we did all this. We did the bowl. We did the call. This is where we're going. All right. So, we have this crusade. Why was the crusade called? What happened? Most of you are here. Most of you should be able to answer this. Why was the crusade called? What happened? What was the big event?
Jerusalem
got taken over, right? By, do you remember? If you don't, it's okay.
Seljuks.
Seljuks are a Turkish people, yeah. They also happen to be Muslim. And they seized Jerusalem from the prior Muslim holders, the Abbasids. And what did the Seljuks do once they got a hold of Jerusalem? That kind of like rankled everyone's feathers. Nobody? They closed it. They kicked out the Christians. Which now meant Christians were no longer to engage in pilgrimages. What's a pilgrimage?
A holy journey.
A holy journey. All right, yeah. So back during this time, people used to travel. Not everybody, people who could afford it, used to travel. They'd make their way to the Holy Land, and they would go and pray at all the sites that are deemed by the church to be spiritual in nature, to attempt to walk in the footsteps of Jesus himself. But now suddenly they were denied this. So who reached out to the Europeans asking for help?
Alexios the First.
And he, who is he? Alexios the First.
He's a Byzantine Emperor.
Byzantine Emperor. All right, very good. So he reached out and he contacts the Europeans and said, hey, yo, can you send some warriors so we can take the holy city back? Okay. Who did he call or contact?
Pope Urban II.
Why did he contact the Pope? Why didn't he just contact a king? What was the one thing that was true for all Western Europeans in about 1000 AD?
According to the feudal system, kings are below the Pope. The Pope has supreme power over everybody.
And the Pope had power over everybody because what was the religion of just about all of Europe?
Christianity.
Catholic. Yeah, so they submitted to him. So you contact the guy who's on top, who then rallies the people below. All right. Does these kings receive actual facts in terms of what was going on? Or did they receive maybe what today we would consider to be a little propagandish? Exactly. Why? Why would they not tell the truth? Why would they embellish? Why would they tell stories? Well, think about what was being asked. Leave your homes, leave your wives, leave your children. Travel thousands of miles to go kill. What could in all likelihood happen to you along the way?
Die.
You could die. Wait a minute. You're going to go to war and try to kill and you could die? What, this isn't like a video game that you could just respawn yourself? How many of you, we did it on class, like nobody raised their hands. No one was willing to go kill the infidel Muslims just because. No one wanted to do it. But then we had to sweeten the pot a little bit. Right? Hi, who are you?
My name's Raymond Carter.
Who?
Raymond Carter.
Were you here last class?
No.
Sit right there. I'm always saying that because it's easy to see the access. Raymond Carter?
Yeah.
Were you in the class or were you at it?
I was in it, but
no big deal. I need to know if you were at it or not, because if you were already in the list, I will see your name when I look at the roster.
Yeah.
But sometimes if you were at it, I don't see it for a day. But you were in it?
Yeah.
Alright, very good. Alright. So we recognize the fact that these people were being called to go march thousands of miles to go kill people. And obviously you had to stir them up with a little bit of propaganda. How did the Pope attempt to sweeten the deal? To get more people to potentially go.
Spiritual forgiveness, we wouldn't go to heaven, or how do you go to purgatory?
And that's called?
Purgatory.
Yeah, no. What's that spiritual forgiveness called?
Indulgence.
An indulgence. Oh, if you are a murderer, or if you are a rapist, or if you are an arson, or you commit assault and battery, if you are violent, which of course the Bible kind of refers to as being sins, all of those sins will be washed away. Go fight for this holy war. Is that enough to get people to sign up? Maybe, some. But the Pope also added something else. It wasn't just a reward in the afterlife. There was a little bit of a reward in the here and now. Which was what?
Land.
Wait, where are they going to get land?
Well, he said that it's free land, so whoever they kill, they can build their land.
The Pope is saying, go kill people and take their land because it's free land? What about the Muslim or the Jew or the pagan that are sitting there and they've had the land and they think it's theirs and it's been theirs for multiple generations? Now suddenly it's not theirs? Why not? What did the Pope say? In a bull, a papal bull. The only people who can own land are Christians. So go kill them all. Alright, so the plan, at least in the Pope's eyes, was that there would be a grand gathering led by the military leaders of the age, the kings and the princes and the dukes and the lords, and they would assemble an army of knights who would depart on a holy day of obligation. To kind of imbue the crusade with a little extra religiosity. You know, some good mojo. Any Catholic in here know what the significance of August 15th is? It's okay. I don't remember all the holy days of obligation myself. August 15th is the Feast of the Assumption. Feast of the Assumption. What, religiously speaking, is the significance of the Feast of the Assumption? Does anyone know what happened? According to church theology. And it was on that day that the physical body of the Virgin Mary was taken to heaven by God. So Mary was not buried. Her body was brought to heaven, where she sits today, body and soul. So, yeah, we're going to go liberate the Holy Land on this very day of spiritual significance, which is going to cause our religious adrenaline to flow. But notice, the Pope put forth the call in November 1095. But the plan wasn't to leave until August of 96. Why didn't they go right away? Why did they wait 10 months?
Gather as many troops as they can.
Gather troops?
Hard to amass an army that big to wipe out a whole bunch of Muslims.
Yeah, you just can't snap your fingers and suddenly, boom, you have thousands of men ready to go. Food, supplies, medicines, clothing, extra horses, and then all of the personnel necessary to keep that army fighting. You need blacksmiths and weaponsmiths and cooks and, well, camp wives and stuff. Hi. Who are you?
Jalen.
Oh, you were here last class. Don't take it personal. I let Vickery take your seat. But you go by JP.
JP.
No? Wait, were you here last class?
No.
That's why. Jalen. J-A-L?
I am.
What's your last name?
Vickery.
Were you in this class, or did you add?
I will add it.
Okay. Do you know what time class started?
9:25.
Oh, what time is it now?
9:42.
There's your 1 minute late tardiness for the class, right?
Semester?
Yeah. All right, anyways, so we have this time necessary to gather forces. Well, during this time, as you can imagine, as word spread, people got excited. True believers got excited. And the problem when you get true believers excited is some of them tend to go to the extreme, no? Any of you support anything? Doesn't necessarily have to be religion, but a cause or a sports team or something like that. You know what always cracks me up? I laugh year after year when it happens. So some team like wins the championship. And what do their fans do? They go down the streets and they flip cars and set buildings on fire. That to me is just fucking stupid. But that's what happens when people get super excited and they are fanatical about the cause. Well, now put this into people's religion. And the highest figure in the church is calling people to go on this holy war. People begin losing their mind. And I got proof. Because before the actual army left, violence began spreading in Europe. The first example are commonly referred to as the Rhineland massacres. Any of you know German geography? Where's the Rhineland? Yeah, it's in and around there. All right, so you have France, right? Then you have Germany. Yes, you got Luxembourg in between, Belgium up here. But there is a region that's Western Germany that shares a border with Belgium and the Netherlands and France. There's a river that goes through there called the Rhine River. It's one of the major rivers of Europe. Well, in that region, there are many cities and large towns and villages. In that region, there was an example of extreme religiosity. Of course, this was culminated by the message that was being put into the church. December 95 into January, February, March of 96, in places like Spire, in Worms, in Metz, people began losing their minds in engaging, launching what today we refer to as pogroms. Heard of this word before? A pogrom? A pogrom is when a mob begins attacking their neighbors. There was, living within many of these cities and towns in the Rhineland, a sizable minority population who were not Catholic and had been living peacefully side by side for hundreds of years. Jews. They had been allowed to migrate in over the centuries. They became a part of the community. They raised their families. They had businesses. They got along swimmingly. But what are Jews not?
Christian.
They're not Christian. What sets the Jews apart from Christians? What do Jews not believe?
That Jesus is the Son of God, that he's a prophet.
Crystal! They don't accept Jesus as being the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God. So they are not Christians. By the way, any of you know the Bible? Who is responsible for what happened to Jesus?
It's either the Jews or Pontius Pilate.
Well, Pilate, you can't blame Pilate. He was just the governor. And his job, as tasked to him by Caesar, was to maintain law and order. But who was it that reported that Jesus was a troublemaker? Because he was going into the temple and flipping over tables and calling them basically all moneylenders. All of those priests of the temple. Caiaphas, the high priest of the temple, encouraged Pontius Pilate to arrest Jesus. And by the way, Roman punishment for rabble-rousing was scourging, when your physical body would be beaten by flails that had little barbs on it, took chunks of flesh out of you, and then crucified. They'd nail you to a cross just outside the city gates, and they would allow you to slowly die of asphyxiation over a day or a two or three. Well, needless to say, at different times in history, the Jews got a bad rap because they were blamed for the death of Jesus. So, these people, mobs, began attacking them because they were different. And then guess what the mobs did? Once they killed their neighbors, because the Pope said they could. It took their houses, took their businesses, took their money. Yep, yep, yep. Perfect. FYI, tens of thousands of Jews were slaughtered during the Rhineland massacres. And many Jewish historians actually refer to this as the first European Holocaust. That's how bad it was. The only thing that stopped it was when priests and bishops began trying to gather the Jews who survived and giving them sanctuary in the church, and then chastising the people who were in the mobs. It's the only thing that stopped it. Not quite Muslims. But again, it's an example of what happens when you fire people up. Questions? Now, FYA, gave you a lot of details, because the details are what's interesting. Do I expect you to remember all that? No. Kind of like what we did at the review, the beginning of class. Just know the gist of things. All right. The second event that took place in this ramp-up to the launching of the Crusades was an unofficial gathering of individuals, mostly peasants. There were some lesser nobles. They gathered together and they decided not to wait for the big army, because they believed that God would deliver them success. This group is known as the People's Crusade. Now, FYI, modern historians believe one of the big factors that encouraged people to gather in this crusade was climate change. Dom, dom, dom. FYI, the weather has always been changing. Every couple of decades, temperatures go up, temperatures goes down. During the period of this 11th century, global temperatures were believed to be at the highest they ever were, higher than they are today. And Europe suffered a tremendous drought. And with the drought meant a decrease in food supplies. So a lot of these people were desperate to go and get free land because the Pope said so. And they believed that because the Pope said so, didn't matter if they didn't know how to fight. That somehow God would send forth the angels and smite all his enemies. Well, it didn't hurt that, I don't know if you can read down here, there was a guy, a preacher, by the name of Peter the Hermit. He kind of was, well, we'll just say he was a showman. He was a charismatic priest. Kind of like, you ever watch any of those televangelists on TV? You know, they get all excited and they get people jumping up for joy and saying, Jesus is going to save you if you just give us money. Well, he was one of those guys. He preached to those people who were desperate, prayed upon their faith, riled them up, and they launched forth. But they had no plan. So, what does this mean? Well, they went by land. They left the central part of Europe, crossed into places like modern Austria, and then into Hungary, and eventually began making their way down into the Balkans, where once Yugoslavia was. Well, that part of the world was still part of the Byzantine Empire. So essentially, this army of 40 to 50,000 people marched into another empire, unannounced. How do you think the Byzantines reacted? Well, I would throw out the hypothetical question, what would happen if 40 or 50,000 people marched into our country, but our previous president allowed it to happen for 4 years? And that's up to 10 million, give or take. Prior to the previous occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, any other president, even Obama, probably would have raised the National Guard or the Army and would have shut down the border. I'm hoping that the current occupant, number 47, will do that. Actually, he's already declared it to be a war zone, which means the Army can actually deploy to the border. It's a good thing. Because what happens when your country gets invaded by thousands and thousands and thousands of people? What in all likelihood is going to happen? You pay attention to the news? What's been happening in our country? Crime. They have nothing. They come in and they start taking from those who have. Well, 40,000 people marched into the Byzantine Empire. Desperate, hungry, they began attacking the villages. They began attacking the people who lived in the Byzantine Empire. They began taking their food. They began ravaging their farms, attacking their stores, taking their clothing. Although, unlike the previous occupant, the emperor called forth the army and had the army attack these peasant people. A battle broke out. The Byzantine soldiers quickly killed a few thousand of the People's Crusade. Until Peter the Hermit rode up and was like, whoa! He claimed to be an embassy of Christ himself, which kind of got the Byzantine soldiers' attention. They eventually took him up, brought him to Constantinople. He met with Alexios. And Alexios was like, what am I supposed to do? People have attacked thousands of my citizens. They've caused millions and millions of dollars in damage. And there's still tens of thousands of them. What do I do with them? Well, he decided the best course of action was to get him out of his country. So he rounded them all up and essentially deported them. Put them on ships and ferried them to the Holy Land. And dropped them off in modern Turkey. Said, there you go, have fun. The only bit of advice that the emperor gave to Peter the Hermit was he told him, go directly to Jerusalem. Don't attack the Turks. But guess what they did? Because the Turks were Muslims. And can Muslims own stuff? Well, the problem was, is that when the Muslims, the Seljuks, found out about this, they descended upon the people's crusade and essentially wiped them out. 20,000 were killed at what was known as the Battle of the Sebatot, which was a small town next to a river in Turkey. You don't even have to remember that. 20,000 killed. The survivors were all enslaved. Yes, the Muslims were the ones who created the slave trade. So 10, 15,000 others put into slavery and just disappeared to history. One of the few survivors, ironically, was Peter the Hermit. Because on the day of the big battle, he was sick. So he stayed behind. Well, this was a huge problem. Because now, the European Catholics have pissed off the Byzantines, and the Turks know something's happening. Now, by the way, side note, for those of you who are of Spanish heritage, it was also at the point that the Reconquista was launched in the Iberian Peninsula. We could be Portuguese as well. Because from the 8th century up until the 10th century, the Muslims controlled most of modern Portugal and Spain. But beginning with the launching of the Middle Eastern Crusade, an Iberian Crusade was launched, and it was called in Spanish the Reconquista, the Reconquest. And it would eventually culminate during the reign of Ferdinand and Isabella, the king and queen of Spain, who gave Columbus the license to sail across the Atlantic. History. Lots of interesting connections. All right. So all that being aside, what about the group that was leaving in August? Well, this marks the beginning of what historians refer to as the true First Crusade. Although to keep all of the Crusades separate, we'll use the nicknames. This First Crusade is commonly referred to as the Prince's Crusade. Anyone want to take a wild stab at why it's called a Prince's Crusade? Guess who was not in charge? What?
The king wasn't in charge.
There was no kings in charge. There were no kings in charge. The reason why no kings were in charge was because all of the kings themselves were either busy or they were elderly. So, the king decided to send the prince. What relationship is the prince to the king? Could be the son, yeah. Any other possible relationship? Could be brothers as well. In Europe, traditionally, when the father dies and the father's the king, who usually replaces the father?
The oldest son,
right. So what happens if the king has more than one son?
It's still the firstborn,
right. But all the rest are still princes. And if the firstborn son has a son of his own, what's going to happen to his younger brother?
Superseded by that.
Well, yeah, chances are he's never going to become king. So if the second or the third son is never going to become king in the home country, He's looking for other opportunities, no? And that's ironically what happened. The eldest son of William the Conqueror, King William I of England, a man by the name of Duke Robert of Normandy, he was one of the big leaders. As was the younger brother of King Philip I of France, a man by the name of Hugh. And other influential, high-ranking members of the royal family. They all joined together and served as co-leaders. Interesting fact right there. Second interesting fact, all of these guys, they were alpha men. They were no little betas. They were all men who had trained for war their whole lives and had engaged in war and had killed others with their own hands. They knew how to fight. They knew how to lead. And those are usually the guys you want in charge of armies, no? Well, they would gather together four armies that combined stood at, give or take, about 50,000 soldiers. About a quarter of them were knights. So they also were nobles. But you also had large numbers of soldiers who typically were mercenaries. These were hard men. They followed in the footsteps of the People's Crusade, but they did not invade Byzantium. They let Alexios know. They made good contact, and Alexios would actually give to them 2,000 of his own soldiers. So as they went, their military capacity increased. They would land in the Holy Land, and they were successful. They liberated many of the major cities and regions that the Muslims had taken control of. Nicaea, which was one of the big cities in modern Turkey. This region of the interior Turkey is commonly referred to as Anatolia. Dozens of smaller cities and villages, a lot of agricultural production there. Then they marched south. They liberated one of the major cities, ancient city in modern Syria, Antioch. They took Edessa. And they eventually would make their way down, lay siege to, and take Jerusalem itself. Unprecedented. Unprecedented. But then they did something which kind of caught a lot of people by surprise. Remember when I said they were mostly the second or the third or the fourth sons of kings? Well, once they seized the major cities and regions, they then divided up the spoils and declared themselves to be kings. And they created their own kingdoms. And initially, there were four major crusader kingdoms: Edessa, Antioch, Jerusalem, and Tripoli. Edessa is here. Antioch is here, modern Syria. Tripoli is Lebanon, Jordan, and then, of course, Jerusalem, much of modern state of Israel. Not only did they take the cities, not only did they take the land, not only did they create kingdoms, but they also defended other Muslim armies that tried reacting to it. So we don't have time to talk about all the different factions of Muslims. But you had the Seljuks here, but there also was another group of Muslims in Egypt known as the Fatimids. Well, when they found out what happened to the Seljuks, they sent a 50,000-man army to march north to help the Seljuks out. And the Crusaders defeated them as well. This army seemed unstoppable. And coincidentally, if you really want to gauge the Crusades by success, really only the First Crusade was successful, because it achieved its objective. But here's the problem. With every action, there is usually what? Reaction. By the way, this is something that took me a lot of years to figure out. Everything you do, no matter what it is, there are consequences. The reaction. And the consequences are unavoidable. There will always be something that happens. Sometimes good, sometimes not so good. So that being said, you had the success. They achieved their goal. They freed the Holy Land. Yay! But in doing so, they coincidentally started the line of dominoes falling that would result in the abject failure of the Crusades 200 years later. The first seed. Alexios was not happy. Because in his mind, the plan was the Crusaders would come and drive the Muslims out, and then all of that land would go back to him. As I mentioned last class, what is Byzantium? Anyone remember? The Eastern Roman Empire. There was one point, as I mentioned last class, where Rome controlled the whole Mediterranean world. The eastern half was the Eastern Roman Empire. That just became known as Rome when Western Rome fell. The Eastern Roman Empire had all of the Balkans, all of modern Greece and that part of the world, had a good chunk of Turkey, had Syria, Jordan, Israel, part of Saudi Arabia, and then stretched across North Africa. Well, when the Prophet Muhammad appeared and he unleashed his Arab warriors, the Muslims slowly had been conquering all of that land. The irony was, is even by the time of the Crusades, the majority of the people in that part of the world were still Christians. They hadn't converted to Islam. So in the minds of the emperor, the Crusaders would come, free the Holy Land, and just give us our land back. And we'd give them money or something. And when he reached out to all of these Crusader kings, and he was like, yo, okay, that's great. Give me the keys to the castle. And the Crusader king said, sorry, dude, go pound sand. We're keeping this for ourselves. He was, let's just say, less than pleased. So, we now have the East and the West Christians, once again, hating on one another. But they also enraged the Muslims. A rage which, by the way, still exists today, over 1,000 years later. Well, actually, no, almost 1,000 years later. The best example that I can give you, and by the way, this is actually how the Crusades are taught if you were a Muslim growing up in the Middle East. I've come across individuals that had that experience and they confirmed it for me. During the siege of Antioch, and what's a siege, by the way?
It's
Anyone know what a siege is?
Isn't it like when you try to get things back? Or no?
No. You're trying to do something, but...
Isn't it like when you're trying to break into, like, some sort of building?
Well, not just a building, but...
Like a castle?
A castle or a city. Why didn't you just go in?
Because you're defending it.
Okay, what was the major super defensive technology that they had? They had a wall. All right. They had a wall. Big stone wall. Why didn't they just blow it up?
Did they have those resources back then?
Guess what they did not have back then?
Bomb.
What causes a bomb to go boom?
Dynamite.
Huh?
Dynamite.
What makes dynamite go boom?
Gunpowder.
Gunpowder. Where was gunpowder invented? China. When did it get to Europe? Not yet. So, back then, if you attacked a city, you couldn't just blow holes in the wall. You had to surround it. What was the purpose of surrounding it? What were you trying to do?
Not let anything in or out.
Basically starve them. Because what does not grow in cities? Food, right? Do you know any cities where large quantities of food are grown? No, so urban centers, cities, even back then, were dependent upon the farmers in the countryside sending wagons full of food into the city every day. So if you couldn't break through the walls, one of the tactics you used to do is surround the city and basically starve them out. By the way, sometimes sieges lasted for a year or two or three. It wasn't an easy thing to do. Well, the problem when you're sitting around for a year or two, not engaging any action, is you probably get bored. Right? You're a soldier, you're gonna go and fight. Big fight. Sit around and watch the wall. Plus, often, the people on the outside suffer similarly as the people on the inside. Because not only are the people on the outside suffering from boredom, how much food do you think is going to them? No, guess what all the local farmers stop doing? So, as bad as the people in the city were suffering, famine, running out of fresh water, the people on the outside were suffering the same thing. And by the way, it got so bad that many of the crusaders had to kill and eat their horses. They began to starve, suffer malnutrition. On top of that, they began having to drink contaminated water. Because guess what the people were doing in the water? Going poo-poos and pee-pees. And eventually, germs started developing in the sources of water. And they began suffering from outbreaks of fun diseases like dysentery. And that kind of causes people to lose their mind. They get very hangry, to say the least. Well, it got so bad that in December of 1098, a group of soldiers decided they were going to go rove the countryside and look for food sources. They just happened to swing by a nearby village that at the time was called Murat al-Numan. Not that you need to remember that. Now, the town was not rich, and the town had little food and little fresh water. Because when the farmers stopped producing to send it to Antioch, the town also suffered similarly. And the crusaders were pissed. So guess what they decided to do? Let's do a little rampage. Let's do a little bit of some murder. Let's do some stabbing. Let's do some throat slitting. Let's also do some raping. And then we'll do some pillaging. There's a little money to take. Once all the fun was done, guess what they still were? Hangry. But then at some point, something extraordinary happened. And here's from a first-hand account by a priest who was in the Crusader ranks. And this is a report that he sent back to Rome. And they quote, "I shudder to tell that many of our people, harassed by the madness of excessive hunger, cut the pieces from the buttocks of the Saracens, already dead there, which they then cooked. But when it was not yet roasted enough by the fire, they devoured it with savage mouth." Apparently, they took the dead adults, chopped them up into little bits, and boiled them in pots. Little children's, they impaled on spigots and had themselves some barbecue. The Crusaders killed an entire population in a village and basically ate them. Is not for every civilization just about cannibalism one of the worst sins you can commit? Well, guess how the Crusaders are propagandized in modern Muslim schools? The devourers of babies. So, not only did the Crusaders piss off the Byzantines, to say that the Muslims were outraged is an understatement. Which meant they were going to come back harder, faster, more lethal. Because now they have a cause. Questions? All right, we'll start the Second Crusade, but we won't be able to get through it. All right. By 1100, the Crusaders securely locked down those kingdoms, had established themselves, and began calling those new kingdoms their homes. Unfortunately, a problem happened. Once the kingdoms were established, while the princes stayed, many of the warriors basically said, "All right, I did my job, I got lots of gold, I'm going to go home to see my wife and my kids." So the army of tens of thousands quickly diminished. When that occurred, that essentially limited the military capability of these Crusader states. Now, they did try to recruit the Christians who were there, but I already talked previously about that whole schism thing. You know, the Eastern Christians were Orthodox Christians. They believed that the patriarch was the head of their church, and they followed the rules of the Eastern Christian church, which was very different than the rules of the Western Christian church, under the control of the papacy. So, even though the Crusader kings were able to recruit some soldiers, their loyalty was just, let's say, not quite so much. Weakened, this opened them up for retaliation by the Seljuks. Because just because the Crusaders took some cities and towns and some real estate, they didn't kill all the Turks. No, 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 no. To two generations later, the Muslims came back in force. On December 24th, 1144, a Seljuk army laid siege to, gained entry to, and ravaged the city of Edessa. Most of the Catholic residents, because some people did migrate from Europe into the Middle East. Many of the people in Edessa just happened to be French. Well, these French Europeans, Catholics, captured in the streets by now the roving band of the Muslim army, were similarly slaughtered as the people of Antioch in the surrounding towns. The only thing the Muslims didn't do is the Muslims didn't eat them. But they too engaged in what we could call atrocities. One of the most significant was when the archbishop of the city, a man by the name of Hugh, gathered in the cathedral women and children. He stood at the door and begged the Seljuks to give pause to the fact that there is no one in the building other than women and children. Well, as payback, the Seljuks shut the door on the archbishop, chained it up, and set the whole cathedral on fire, burning alive hundreds of women and children, and the archbishop. Well, needless to say, word spread. It would eventually get to Rome, which inspired the then Pope, Eugene III, to call for another crusade to get revenge on the Seljuks for what happened to the French in Edessa. But what he did was a little different, because he knew the deal of his predecessor. You know, the original call by Urban. You do an indulgence, if you go to the crusade, and you can get land. Well, he knew that wouldn't be enough. So what he had to do is he had to sweeten the deal. In calling for a crusade, he would issue his own bull. And by the way, what's a papal bull? If the Pope issues a bull, what is it? It's a law for who?
The Pope.
No, it's a law made by the Pope for who?
The people.
The Catholics. So if the Pope issues a bull, you as a Catholic, if you're a Catholic, you are legally obligated to obey. This bull was Quantum Praedesoris, which translates essentially to how much will we give for our predecessors? How much will we give for our predecessors? In other words, he's calling in particular for the French to rise up and go get revenge for their countrymen who died in Edessa. Now here's the catch. Here's the catch. An indulgence would be granted if you pick up the cross. And the indulgence are for those sins that you caused before you pick up the cross. So it's a way to get your background basically wiped clean. Well, what happens if you engage in cannibalism like the people of Antioch in the siege of Antioch? Well, guess what? There was no indulgence for them. They were going to suffer their fate. You eat some little baby on a spigot, you're going to hell. Well, the Pope realized he needed even more fierce warriors than the group that went before. But are you going to go engage in fierce violence, eat babies if you know you're going to go to hell? Probably not. So in Quantum Predatorius, he, not literally, proverbially, states, if you go on this crusade, anything you do on the crusade will be forgiven. Anything you do on the crusade will be forgiven. So if you rape women, you eat babies, it's all good, bro. Because I say so. I'm the Pope. Well, even though the Pope was trying to basically humiliate the French into responding, because by the way, at the time, France was the largest economy. France also had the most nobles and thus had the most warriors. Unexpectedly, it was actually a German king who answered the call first. Now, he wasn't the king of Germany, technically, but he was a king of Germany in the sense that he was one of many kings because Germany wasn't a country. So I guess I could say he was a German king, but not the king of Germany. That might be more clear. He was the head of the Hohenstaufen dynasty, which when we talk about it, would eventually, his family would rise and become the Holy Roman Emperors. You know, the king of kings amongst all the German kings and princes. But anyways, so he answers the call. He gathers together an army of German soldiers and begins marching from his kingdom down to the Holy Land. But he had lots of problems besides the fact that it was a long ride. One of the biggest problems that he faced was he did not learn the lessons of the First Crusade. He did not send advanced word. He marched into Byzantine territory like the People's Crusade. And when they arrived, the Byzantine soldiers thought they were being invaded. So they attacked and defended their country. Eventually, a parley occurred. They stopped fighting, they talked, figured things out. But then while they were recovering, a violent storm erupted, which caused the snows in the mountains to melt quicker than expected, which triggered a flood that swept downrange. And like the poor people in parts of North Carolina and Tennessee, as the rains came down through the river valleys, death and destruction was caused. And many Germans would lose their lives as they got swept away in the middle of the night. So now, they lose men. They lose more men. Eventually, they get helped across into Turkey, and they began trying to push into Seljuk territory. Because this is where they're going, Edessa. Well, the problem is Conrad was not an experienced war leader. He was the leader by birth. He was the king. He was born to be that. But he didn't quite receive the training necessary to be effective. If you don't know how to fight, what in all likelihood is going to happen to you when you have to fight? Why? Why are you going to lose?
We got experience.
There you go. He made one of the biggest tactical mistakes that you can make if you're commanding an army. He divided his forces. At the time, he had two types of troops. He had the knights, who were on horseback, and the rest of his soldiers were infantry, which meant their form of transportation was the oldest form of transportation in the history of humankind, their feet. Well, the Seljuks, what they do, their type of fighting, is primarily horseback, but it's quick strikes. Like, there's no, armies that march up to one another, like in phalanxes and smash, you know, like the Greeks, the Romans used to. No, what the Seljuks would do is they have small, quick horses. They would ride close, use their short bows, pelt your army with a bunch of arrows, and then quickly ride off. And then maybe they'll swoop in again from another angle or another angle. Well, one such group came in, and Conrad got pissed. And he's like, oh, there's only a couple hundred of them. So he ordered all of his knights to get on their horses and to race out in pursuit, which is just what the Seljuks hoped. Because as the small band of Seljuks quickly went into a valley, and the knights, without doing any reconnaissance, plowed in after them, they didn't realize they would be led into a trap. Because once they got into the middle of the valley, guess who was along the ridges on both sides? Like shooting fish in a barrel. Almost all of the knights were slaughtered. Conrad was injured, and out of sheer luck, he was dragged out. Before the Seljuks closed both entrances to the valley. He was injured so bad, he would eventually get put on a ferry and would be brought back to Constantinople, leaving one of his brothers in charge of the infantry. What usually happens when you have an army of foot soldiers fighting against armies of guys on horses? Well, once the Seljuks knew that the knights were wiped out, they just began encircling and killing, encircling and killing, encircling and killing. Of the thousands that went in, only a few hundred survived. Questions? All right. How about the French king? Well, he got his troops together, and he marched almost following the same paths as Conrad. And spoilers, he didn't do much better. He marched forward. He did give advance word to Byzantium, unlike Conrad, but that wasn't good enough, because by the time he arrived, the king of Byzantium, the Byzantine emperor, Manuel, actually negotiated a ceasefire with the Seljuks. So their ongoing war was at a pause. And by the way, if you are not fighting a war and you help an enemy army, that kind of is an act of war. So Manuel basically told Louis, I'll sail you to Turkey, but I'm not giving you any soldiers, not giving you any food, no weapons. Got that. Then when he arrived in Turkey, he managed to stumble upon some of the German survivors. And the Germans were like, those Seljuks, they're crazy. Don't follow for their ruse. Which, of course, he quickly ignored. In the same region where the Germans were defeated, he began losing forces almost as bad as the Germans. So much so, he decided to give up on the crusade. The crusade was to go free Edessa. He then decides to go meet with the other crusader kings. And when he met with the crusader kings, he got roped into an action in which they were engaging in, because the crusaders were trying to seize the city of Damascus to try to drive the Muslims back even further. Louis shows up and he's like, okay, I'll help you out. The French forces join with the crusader forces. They attempt to lay siege to Damascus. 60,000 combined Christian soldiers descend on the city. But when they arrive, they learn that a Muslim reinforcing army got there first. There was more than enough food and supplies to feed close to 80,000 Muslim warriors. Well, when word spread, one by one, the crusader king said, I'm taking my soldiers and I'm going home. Leaving Louis there pretty much himself. And at some point, he had an epiphany. Wait, why the hell am I doing this? I'm not supposed to be attacking Damascus. Screw this. I'm going home. He decides he couldn't trust the crusader kings. They set him up for failure, and he left. He gets on a boat, sails to Constantinople, gathers up the remnants of Conrad's forces, along with the German king, and they go back to Europe. And this is the biggest consequence. And this is the last click of the day. So, not only do the Muslims hate the Crusaders, and not only were the Byzantines mad at the Crusaders, but now the Europeans hate the Byzantines. Well, if you're trying to fight this spiritual war, would you not want as many friends and allies as possible? That's the reason why the Second Crusade is known as the Failed Crusade. Questions. All right. So, the homework for the people who were here on Thursday, keep going through the book to see if you can figure out what you want to write a paper about. Send me an email as soon as you figure it out. For the people that added in or were new today, go on my website. You got to listen to the recording. Oh, some of you came after I explained the website. P-R-O-F, write this down if you will, some of the last people to come in. And by the way, if you know what I'm talking about, you're free to go. Thank you. Have a wonderful day. Stay warm. P-R-O-F, Prof, P-R-O-F, L-I-M-A-N-E-K, proflamanic.com. Yep. In the audio lecture section, I post recording. I record all my classes. So you can go in and you can listen to it. And I spend the first half of the class going over that website, telling everything that's there, and just laying out my expectations. So if you have any questions, send me an email. Okay. All right?
And then we have to email you about...
Top.
On a paper?
Yep, you got to write a paper. That's on the lecture. It's all explained there.
It's on the final paper or just...
It's on the final paper, yeah. I want to know the topic first.
Okay.
I have a question.
Yes, I have an answer. 12.
That I do like.